Up the long ladder, and down the short rope. To hell with King Billy, to hell with the Pope. Songs of the New Ireland. John sat in the far back of the armored car with only a slit in the steel beside him, through which he could see the passing countryside, everything green upon green in the morning light. It was cold outside, and the steel chilled his skin when he touched it. The seat was not padded. Father Michael and the boy occupied the seat in front of him. The boy curled up asleep with his head against the priest. The driver and an armed guard in front were a taciturn pair, ruddy-faced youths in military green, dark-haired, both of them, with an oddly cynical alertness in their manner, as though they listened to some unseen speaker who warned them of terrible things to come. Another armored car went in front about 100 meters away, and 2 more followed, all 3 fully manned. There was a rocket launcher on the car in the van. There had been no sign of Herity since that last glimpse of him heading off for Kilmainham jail, and Father Michael nor any of the others could or would say where he had gone. Father Michael leaned forward, dislodging the boy beside him and arousing a sleepy moan from him. The priest spoke to the driver, the words not audible to John, but the driver's answer carried clearly to the rear. "We go by the way that's reasonably safe, Father. The long way is often the shortest these days." Father Michael nodded and leaned back. The armored car bounced and jerked in the rough spots. The road went winding up through hills, giving an occasional glimpse down through lanes of conifers toward the Irish Sea, with houses and smoking chimneys, touches of glistening ice wherever John could see fresh water in the breaks. It was scenery of such ordinary splendor that it produced a sense of electric disturbance in John, stirring O'Neill within to cavernous whimpers, small cries, and always that awful scream waiting there in the caves of his mind. The view down to the sea should not appear untouched. There should be signs on the land that the old Ireland had vanished. Otherwise, what was the purpose? The driver turned to his companion and said something. John heard only the 2 words at the end, spoken louder as the rumblings of the armored car increased on a steepening climb. "But now," those 2 words at the end of a statement, the recurrence of those same 2 words and nothing spoken after them, struck John as a verbal mark of the New Ireland. This thought soothed O'Neill within, and left John alone to reflect. "But now," a more descriptive expression of the times might not be found. Nothing came after now. Men had thought once they could solve any problem, scientific or otherwise, if they set about it with scrupulous persistence and good will, with a patience that cared nothing for time. At least, that was the scientific way to think. But now, what could he do at the Killaloe facility? Were Doheny's darkest fears to be proved true? That could not be. He thought about his departure from Doheny that morning. It had been dark before dawn, cold in the office. The light over Doheny's desk had been a yellow island in the gloom. Doheny had been busy signing a stack of papers, passing them to an old man who waited beside him, a stoop-shouldered old fellow who took the papers in a knobby-knuckled hand, straightening them on the desk before departing with them. Not a word spoken between the 2 men the whole time. John had busied himself moving around the office, looking at the photographs on the walls, peering closely at them in the dim light. He stopped at one, caught by the mystery of a partly defaced sign on a brick wall. He tried to make out the wording. "If you have for me about murd exposens in midday in or ter or is in cup eat conf ence call be ast 651555. Seeing John's attention on the photograph, Doheny said, "I keep that as a reminder." It was mostly useless. Words instead of actions. Nothing but words, and very little action. The message is there, though, and the rulers in Ulster put great store by it. The thing is an interesting comparison with our present problem. When the missing parts are restored, the sign reads, "If you have information about murder, explosions, intimidation, or of terrorism, in complete confidence, call Belfast 65155. John turned and looked down at Doheny, feeling a surge of turmoil at the man's words. Terrorism. "The madman sent us a message with missing parts," Doheny said. He nodded at the photograph. "That sign was in Derry. Belfast was the central point for gathering intelligence." John spoke slowly while staring at the photograph. "Terrorism. Intelligence about men like Joseph Herity. And about the prods, too. There was little to choose between them if you were a target for the bullets on the bombs." John turned slowly, reluctantly. Doheny gazed up at him benignly, a glint of cynical humor in the dark eyes. The man appeared so like a fuzzy-haired doll there under the yellow light, the morning painting gray on the window behind him. "We had something close to 60,000 souls there then," Doheny said. "Now? I'd say no more than 4,000 or 5,000 men living in and around. A city dies without its women." John cleared his throat, but did not speak. "Trade it is that keeps a city going," Doheny said. "But trade's a dependency of the home. A city..." He flicked a glance at the photograph behind John. "A city is a place for artisans, for shopkeepers, delivery men and the like. But women are at the heart of a city's trade. Men alone are forced back onto the land, grubbing their food from the dirt and rediscovering what it means to be a husbandman." "Strange word, that." John looked at the top of the window frame, unable to meet Doheny's stabbing gaze. "That colour photograph to the right of the sign is of the same sign from across the river," Doheny said. "That little white spot there, you can't read it from that far away, even if it's complete." John turned and looked at the photograph, a study of the old city of Derry, its rock walls chipped and scarred by the conflicts of centuries, dirty brown rocks rising above the river foil, and low to one side, the little white rectangle with its black lettering. "The men who are still there won't leave," Doheny said. "But there's no meaning to the wage packet anymore. They'll be gone soon enough." "It's the wage packet, you know, John. The foundation of the family presence, source of housing, food, clothing, entertainment. Now I ask you straight, John, how many sources of wage do you suppose could be found today in Derry?" John turned back to Doheny and that pinioning stare. "Not many." "What good are incomplete messages?" Doheny asked. "But it's our literary fantasy to persist." John moved away from the wall, going around the desk to the stiff wooden chair. Something in those photos had contaminated him. The chair was cold and hard beneath him. Doheny's gaze followed him, expression unwavering. As he stared out the slit in the armored car, John thought about that conversation. The convoy was crossing a long stretch of high bog with newly cut turf ricks neatly thatched, a patch of dark plastic at each peak weighted there by stone. It was such an ordinary scene that he could feel it once more arousing O'Neill within. Father Michael turned suddenly and stared at John. "They're still cutting turf," John said. Father Michael spoke in a low voice, not to disturb the boy beside him.
"The hydroelectric dam at Ardna Crusha was blown away early. We've only the peat-burning stations now, and not many men as will cut the peat for them."
John noted that the priest had put on a V-necked grey sweater with white buttons under his black suit. He had exchanged his hat for a black watch cap. The sweater was close to the colour of one worn by a toothless old guard in the hospital courtyard. Doheny had left John there alone with the man, going away to see what's keeping the cars. The old man's sweater had been hand-knit, thick yarn, and the slight imperfections that only the hand could impart. John had stood on the stones, aware of the damp cold in the morning. There were patches of blue overhead, the mist lifting. His attention kept coming back to the old man standing there so watchfully silent, the thin chest under the gray sweater. His wife's hands made that sweater, John thought. Even as John thought this, the old man pulled the sweater close around him against the chill. The thing gapped with a missing button at the bottom. The knitting had a begrimed look as though it had never been washed, and John thought, the old man wants that second-hand touch of her in this garment that her fingers worked. He heard the whisper of O'Neill within, then. Is there nothing left that Mary touched? Tears burned his eyes. The old man looked away at some noise outside the courtyard, bent his head to listen, and when he turned back, his watchful stare was gone. It was a withered face, a witless eye and a mouth where the teeth were no more. And that was all. He spoke in a cracked voice.
You're the one come in with the priest.
That's right.
Warn that one not to start up the church and the mass here, the old man said. I'll wind his cassock around his breastpipe if he tries.
John was astonished at the bitter strength in the old voice, a strength that did not move up to the eyes nor touch the mouth, as though that toothless hole were only a mechanical speaker for a message from deep within. You don't want Father Michael celebrating the Mass? John asked.
Celebrating?
The old man spat on the courtyard stones, then spoke in a weak voice as though the one word had used him up.
I'm an old man with all me nimble days gone, most of me power spent. There's no more quickness in me, and I'll go no more to Mass, because I think too much there of me Fiona kneeling and praying.
Fire returned to the cracked voice.
What have her prayers brought, except a loneliness?
John felt O'Neill within, a silent watcher, fascinated by the toothless mouth and its bitter words.
I was born at midnight, and can see the shades of the dead,
the old man said.
If I squints me eyes proper, and if I stares at one place long enough, I see me old woman there at the fire, just as real as life, cooking me breakfast porridge.
The old man squinted his eyes and peered across the inner spaces of the courtyard. His voice fell almost to a whisper.
It's not like the memories of old pains. They can be made gone, you know. This is the pain that goes not away. This is the pain you can feel without the knowing. It's in the skull it is, and it won't stop short of the grave.
He shook his head feebly.
Mayhap, not even there.
Doheny returned then, striding across the stones from the arched entrance, a strangely vigorous walk in such a heavy man. The old man gave him a limp salute as Doheny stopped.
They're picking up Father Michael and the boy right now, Doheny said. Be along in a minute. Has old Barry here been whiling away your time with a story?
John nodded. Doheny patted the old man on the shoulder.
Get along out to the entrance, Barry. Wave a hand when they come up. We'll join you then.
Doheny spoke to John while keeping his attention on the old man walking away from them.
Some among us live in the hope of revenge.
He cast a quick glance at John.
Some in despair, and some lost in whatever pleasures they can find. Drink, drugs, hideous parodies of sex with no hope of progeny.
He nodded toward the old man who had taken up station in the middle of the entrance arch, his attention directed to the right.
Barry there wants only to meet the madman and ask one question. Are you satisfied with what you've done?
Again Doheny glanced at John.
We're most of us beyond fatigue.
He cleared his throat and John thought he would spit, but Doheny swallowed.
We have our various ways of avoiding reality. If you forced us to face it every moment of our days, we'd all go mad.
The rumbling of several vehicles could be heard at a distance on the street outside. The old man bent forward to stare in that direction. Doheny said,
O'Neill's revenge was, I suppose, his way of not facing his reality. And the terrorists who outraged him, the bomb, that was their way of avoiding their reality.
Again he looked at John, a fixed stare.
You'll find even a bit of sympathy around for that poor madman O'Neill.
John rubbed his throat, unable to turn away from Doheny's gaze.
If you have no alternative to despair, you may explode, Doheny said. We had only the role models of our fathers, the examples in the church and state and family. Violent and angry and painful.
Doheny turned toward the entrance.
Ah, there they are now.
John looked up to see the old man waving to them. An olive-green armored car was visible in the archway beyond him.
When you get to Killaloe, Doheny said, make them give you some fresh clothing. Stuff that fits. You should be comfortable, at least.
Riding toward Killaloe in the armored car, John returned again and again to that strange scene in the hospital courtyard. The old man, Doheny. It had been like theater prepared only for him. To what purpose? Was it a fishing expedition aimed at O'Neill? O'Neill within remained quiescent. No sighs, no whispering, not even the echoes of screams, nor the howling like that of a bereft dog. That was the most terrible sound of all. The howling.
The old man in the courtyard remained bothersome. John felt sympathy for him.
It was the sympathy he felt for O'Neill. Both had suffered tragic bereavement. And what could the poor old fellow do about it? Guard a doorway? Run errands for Doheny, perhaps? Fill out his days until he died? Alone. John had not imagined old men like that in Ireland, nor for that matter any silent boys. Tears slid down John's cheeks. He closed his eyes against them, and when he opened them, found Father Michael staring across the back of the seat at him. John patted the seat beside him.
Father, please join me.
Gently, not to awaken the sleeping boy, Father Michael disengaged himself from the cradled head and slid over the seat, clumsily bumping into John and lurching to the position beside him as the car turned a sharp corner.
What is it, John?
The priest asked.
Will you hear my confession, Father?
John whispered.
It has come at last,
Father Michael thought. He had suffered premonitions of this moment since first seeing John beside the lake. That strangely depilated head, the tortured face now covered by a beard, but the eyes still burning with terrible fires.
Yes, of course, Father Michael said.
John waited while the priest found his case under the seat and arrayed himself for the ancient ritual. John felt calm, calmer than he could remember since
he could not remember ever being this calm.
Father Michael leaned toward him.
How long has it been since your last confession, my son?
The question confused John. He had never been to confession. John Garrick O'Donnell had never said the words that lay now on the tip of his tongue. He uttered them.
Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned.
Yes, my son, how have you sinned?
Father, I have John Roe O'Neill within me.
A blank expression swept over the priest's face. He whispered hoarsely,
You are O'Neill?
John stared at him.
Why didn't the priest understand? No, Father. I'm John O'Donnell. But I have O'Neill within me.
Father Michael's eyes went wide, a glazed look of fascination. He had learned his psychology from a good Jesuit, Father Ambrose Dreyfus, a doctor and an expert in Freud and Jung and Adler and Reich and the permutations between. The concept of schizophrenia was not foreign to Father Michael.
But this, the enormity,
the danger. The habits of the confessional preserved him. Yes, my son. Please continue.
Continue?
John sat in bewilderment. How could he continue? He had said it all. He felt like a raped woman carrying the rapist's child and being asked by a male gynecologist, "And what other symptoms do you have?" When John remained silent, Father Michael asked,
"Does O'Neill wish to confess through you?"
John sensed the terrible stirring within, the start of the howl.
"No."
He pressed his hands against his ears, knowing as he did it that nothing would keep out the sounds of that awful anguish. Father Michael sensed the dismay and said in his most calming voice,
"You wish to confess for yourself?"
John held himself still for several long heartbeats, lowering his hands only when he sensed the calmness returning.
"For myself," he whispered.
Father Michael lurched into John as the armored car negotiated a rutted turn, growling loudly in reduced gears. The priest glanced forward. The driver and guard appeared unaware of the drama in the rear. The boy still slept. His mouth close to the priest's ear, John whispered,
"It's a terrible burden, Father."
Father Michael felt that he had to agree. An awesome sense of compassion swept over him.
The poor man, driven insane, yet coming here in the shy and persistent identity of John O'Donnell, wanting to help,
a maddened creature within him trying to undo the terrible wrong.
"Help me, Father," John pleaded.
Father Michael placed a hand on John's head, feeling the neck muscles stiffen at the touch, and then relax as John bent his head.
How could such anguish be relieved? The priest wondered.
What penance could possibly be assigned? He sensed the other persona, O'Neill, waiting for him to speak.
"Please, Father," John whispered.
Father Michael went into automatic, whispering the familiar absolution and benediction. Only the penance remained. What could he assign? How could anyone help this poor creature?
"God, help me,"
Father Michael prayed. The solution filled his awareness, and he felt blessed calm as he spoke.
"John, you must do everything in your power to find a cure for this plague. That is your penance."
He made the sign of the cross on John's forehead, feeling that he had personally assumed John's burden. What priest had ever before been asked to keep such an awful secret under the seal of the confessional? Perhaps only Christ himself had known such a weight. Father Michael could not tell. John sat in silent withdrawal, his eyes closed tightly, fists clenched in his lap. Father Michael sensed the man's disturbance, but could not hear the howling.
"One of the key characteristics of an elite corps is its susceptibility to those more powerful than itself. Elite power is naturally attracted to a power hierarchy and fits itself neatly, obediently, into the one that promises the most personal benefits. Here is the Achilles heel of armies, police, and bureaucracies."
Yost Hupp. Rupert Stoner, political watchdog on Huddersfield's plague research, stood directly under a spotlight in Hupp's working lab. Light glistened off glassware on the table beside him. It picked out lines of red in his unruly sandy hair. His expression had been carved in rock. It was past midnight, but Hupp did not know how much passed. He had left his watch on his bedside table when answering the summons and had not been given time enough even to glance at it. A tough Royal Marine, someone Hupp had never seen before, had escorted him to the lab and left him about a pace from Stoner. There was no one else in the room. Hupp felt at a disadvantage in a bathrobe. As the Royal Marine left, Stoner said, "Post a guard and let no one else in here."
"Yes, sir."
Hupp decided he did not like the disdainful stare in Stoner's pale blue eyes. There had been a great many military types around in the halls and on the grounds. and Hupp did not like that either, but he kept his feelings to himself.
"What is happening?"
Hupp asked. "You're at a critical stage in your researches," Stonar said. "How critical?" How had Stonar found out? Hupp wondered. He said, "Wouldn't it be better if you talked to Wycombe Finch or Dr. Beckett?"
"Why do you not suggest I talk to Dr. Ruckerman? After all, has he not recently made a thorough study of the work at this facility?"
So Stonar also knew what Ruckerman had brought, Hupp realized. This could get sticky. He said, "Ruckerman would be a good choice."
"Where is he?"
"He'll be brought to me when I'm ready for him."
"But why me?"
Hupp asked.
"I must be certain to get the truth. Your family is closer and more accessible to us. Consequences of a lie would be extremely painful to you."
All of this was uttered in a flat monotone, knotting Hupp's stomach with fear.
"Janine, the boys."
Hupp knew only too well how precarious was their safety in the Dordogne Reserve.
"What have you achieved?" Stonar asked.
"We are approaching a precise biochemical description of the plague," Hupp said.
"Would you stake your life on that?"
"Yes."
Hupp stared back at Stonar, thinking how appropriate was the man's nickname. Stony. Those eyes had been chipped from sapphire.
"Does this mean that presently you will be able to reproduce the plague?
Or an antidote?"
"Convince me."
Hupp glanced down the length of his cluttered lab. Not a chair in sight. This was not the place he would have chosen for an interview. Too much evidence of his own volatility.
"It's quite complex," Hupp said.
"Simplify it."
Hupp groped in his robe pocket for his glasses. Anything for a prop. The Royal Marine had not allowed him time to dress, and now Hupp remembered that his glasses were with his watch on the bedside table. His feet were cold, protected only by slippers from the hard floor.
"The intertwining helix bends back and forth on itself," Hupp said. "You see this, for example, in the gene for botulinus or cholera toxin, and even for ordinary enteric organisms."
"Enteric?" Stonar asked.
"Things that can live in the small intestine."
"Are you saying O'Neill could have changed an ordinary organism into something like cholera?"
"Could have, yes. But he didn't.
The plague is no ordinary viral genome. It is something nature could not have produced without human intervention.
Do you understand the general recombinant DNA procedure?"
"Assume that I know nothing."
Hupp blinked. Stonar must know quite a bit about the recombinant process by now.
He shrugged, then, "It's a kind of cut-and-paste procedure using enzymes, mostly. You cut up the plasmid DNA and introduce foreign DNA before reinserting the plasmid in the host. A plasmid is a kind of miniature chromosome, a circlet of double-stranded DNA present in bacteria in addition to the bacteria's main single chromosome. The plasmid replicates each time the cell divides."
"Go on." Hupp started to speak, but was interrupted by a disturbance in the hall outside. He recognized Wycombe Finch's voice and someone else saying,
"Leave, or you will be removed bodily."
Stonar seemed not to notice. He asked,
"What does the new genetic material do to the host?"
"It carries new information, permitting the cell to do new things. But it isn't essential to the cell's life except under unusual circumstances."
"As in the plague?"
"Exactly. O'Neill created an exquisitely balanced set of genes that enter an ecological niche never before occupied by a disease organism.
You have not completed your biochemical description, and you already know this."
"We deduced it quite a ways back. The plague not only binds up bodily mechanisms that might battle such an invasion, it also blocks vital enzymes, creating a very swift pseudo-aging process. And most terribly, it locks itself in place."
"That
zipper idea.
Something like that.
Stonar glanced around the lab. Messy, damned place. It was from just such a place that this hideous plague had originated. He returned his attention to Hupp, a man he considered to be a wily little frog. They all lied. "Can it be disengaged from its locked position?" he asked.
"We'll be able to answer that question more definitely once we know its exact shape, but we're already pretty sure it can be."
"You're not really sure," Stonar accused.
"Mr. Stonar, these things are strings of amino acids. Each string ends in a single chain, a condition not generally found in nature, because the reproduction process would tend to weed them out."
"Why is the plague not weeded out?" Hupp took a shallow, trembling breath. He longed for Beckett's presence. Bill was much better at this sort of thing.
"O'Neill created a living factory," Hupp said. "It reproduces his pathogen and is dependent upon that reproduction for its continued existence."
"Are you telling me that you will not be able to answer my question until the very moment when you can reproduce this plague?"
"I warned you it was complex."
"And I warned you to simplify it." There was death in Stoner's voice. Hupp tried to swallow in a dry throat. He said,
"The genetic information for a protein that can be made in one kind of cell must be transferred to another kind of cell. Before O'Neill, we believed we could change only a few characteristics by recombinant procedures, nowhere near enough to achieve a dramatic new disease such as the plague. We thought we could only remake old disease in new guises. O'Neill's pathogen is no ordinary spinning out of a simple amino acid strand. The enzymic and other splitting procedures are extraordinary. We are learning remarkable things from him. Remarkable."
Hupp's voice trailed off into a musing tone. Then,
"I don't think he realized."
"What didn't he realize?"
"Our discoveries may be of far greater value than... they may far outweigh the effects of the plague."
Stoner regarded Hupp with a baleful stare. Then, "Of course, your family is still among the living." Hupp was brought up short by realization of how much Stoner must have lost to the plague. He spoke quickly.
"I don't mean to make light of the plague. I'm trying to take a longer view. Humankind has taken an agonizing step. I'm saying the gigantic nature of that step has yet to be recognized."
"You're not suggesting history may look back on the madman as a hero?"
"Oh, no. But he has led us into a new understanding of genetics."
"Fah," Stoner said. Hupp, lost in his musings, did not hear.
"We have been lifted to new horizons. I am in awe of what I see."
"You scientist types scare the bloody hell out of me," Stoner said. Hupp heard this and was shocked to an abrupt remembrance of the power in Stoner's hands. Hupp said,
"I must point out, sir, that it was not scientists who drove O'Neill insane.
A violent extension of politics unfortunately struck a man who was competent."
"Mother of Christ, what an inadequate English word.
Not competent, but unusually gifted in this dangerous field." "You'll let me know when you're ready to admit O'Neill to your august ranks?" Now, alert to the tones in Stoner's voice, Hupp heard the derision.
"Pandora's box has been open for a long time," Hupp said. "There's no way to prevent such things as this plague unless we find a way to prevent political insanity, including insane terrorism and the injustices of police states. You haven't the vaguest idea of the extent to which government can go in suppression," Stoner said.
"However, I did not come here to discuss political philosophy.
I think that's beyond your competence.
You believe you could have prevented an O'Neill by some kind of surveillance?
We will return to the matter at hand, Stonar said. Which is your description of this plague. How do you achieve this?
It's based on a lot of clues, some supplied by the Irish and others,
brought here by Dr. Ruckerman.
He's helped, yes, Hupp admitted. As I said earlier, the intertwined helix of DNA bends back and forth upon itself. This bending is extremely interesting. We have now discovered that the shape of submolecular elements in the DNA can be inferred from these bends and twists.
It dawned on us that O'Neill had developed a new field disruption mass spectrometer technique, a soft technique for analysis of the products from the pyrolysis of DNA.
What?
He used stereoisomers, left and right hand. He burned them, superimposed the spectrometer images, and deduced the submolecular shape from the... It's like seeing a shadow on a shade and deducing the shape that must have projected that shadow.
You see, Stonar said, you can simplify when your life depends on it.
Hart did not reply.
Dr. Ruckerman has told his president that you are almost ready to do amazing things, Stonar said. Does Y agree?
Dr. Wycombe Finch?
Hupp scratched his head, stalling for time in which to think.
I think he'd like to give us carte blanche to explore the disease template we are producing.
But he has other people and their projects to consider.
That's about it. We are already taking about half the available computer time.
You're sure you can't yet tell me whether your plague, template, will lead to a cure?
Hupp shrugged, a gesture that Stonar found offensive.
You don't know?
We'll be able to answer that after we've achieved our biochemical description of the plague.
Would it help if you had more of this facility's resources at your disposal?
Perhaps, but only after we've
achieved your description of the plague. Yes, understand me, Hupp, I don't like you. You're the kind of person who created this disaster. You,
sir,
it is not my suggestion that you are insane enough to try following in O'Neill's steps. At any rate, you'll be carefully watched, and that will not be allowed. I consider it unfortunate that we need you at all. I caution you not to overestimate the extent of that need.
You are the undoubted son of a Montmartre whore, Hupp thought.
He remained silent. A faint smile touched Stoner's lips and was gone. He turned on a heel and went to the door. Opening the door, he said, "Bring in Ruckerman."
Will Ruckerman had been awakened in much the same way as Hupp, but he had been allowed to dress and then had been held under guard in an equipment storage room across from Hupp's lab.